is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suwuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We can say with confidence that about 95% of our schools have been ably provided with all the necessary COVID-19 imperatives. For the remaining 5% or so of learners, alternative measures have been developed by different districts and provinces. Some of them include using neighboring schools just to make sure no learner must be left behind.
That's South Africa's basic education minister on the phased reopening of schools starting today. Details coming up. Also, the U.S. has provided $400 million worth of assistance to African countries since the outbreak of the COVID pandemic. Meanwhile, the U.N. is releasing $40 million to help tackle a new Ebola outbreak in the DRC. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. South Africa reopened schools today as the number of COVID-19 infections nears 50,000 mark with 1,000 deaths. Thousands of grade 7 and 12 students were the first group in the phased return. As Tuso Kubalo reports from Johannesburg, not all parents are happy, but the government has left them with little choice.
Thousands of students are back to school after close to 3 months of absence, including a month-long dispute between teachers' unions and the government over conditions for reopening. It was finally agreed that only grade 7 in primary school and grade 12 in high school should return first. Each school had a temperature screening device at the entrance, and students were being sanitized and wearing masks in and outside the premises. Strict social distancing measures have been set, including classroom seating arrangements and during recess. Basic Education Minister Angie Motshekga says everything has been done to ensure the schools do not become COVID-19 transmission centers.
We can say with confidence that about 95% of our schools have been ably provided with all the necessary COVID-19 imperatives. For the remaining 5% or so, alternative measures have been developed by different districts and provinces. Some of them include using neighboring schools just to make sure no learner must be left behind.
However, some parents are angry and upset, with some worried about the risk of contracting COVID-19 on public or school transport. Millicent Siromo, with siblings and relatives now mixing with other students, described the reopening as a recipe for disaster. She says temperature screening is not enough to guarantee everyone is clear of the coronavirus.
Since they were never tested before they could go back to school, what if there are children that got this virus from their homes? And this could be a danger, because now they could be taking this virus from home and spreading it to other children at school.
And Karabo Mabaso does not agree with the government that students will avoid contact playing and other actions that will endanger their lives.
So I don't think it's a good thing that they should open, because this thing spreads and you can't even see it. And at schools, kids, like, they would want to exchange masks. They would want to, like, wear the other kids. Like, their masks will even get dirty from falling. So it's not a good thing. I don't approve it at all.
However, the government says only children with underlying health conditions will be allowed to stay at home. Parents who choose to homeschool will be subjected to strict monitoring by the education department. Some teachers' unions have said they are only allowing their members to return to work conditionally and will advise them to withdraw if the government fails to provide adequate protection. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The United States has provided assistance worth $400 million to countries throughout Africa since the outbreak of the global COVID-19 pandemic. Speaking to African reporters recently, senior American officials said the funds are specifically aimed at helping governments and non-governmental organizations to fight the pandemic. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, VOA's Ruben Chama reports.
To date, the U.S. government has committed more than $1 billion to benefit the global COVID response in more than 120 countries. Since the outbreak began, the Department of State and USAID have provided millions of dollars throughout Africa to ramp up disease preparedness and control capability. Kenneth Staley is the U.S. Agency for International Development, Global Malaria Coordinator, and leader of the USAID COVID-19 Task Force.
Since the outbreak began, the Department of State and USAID have provided almost $400 million throughout Africa, specifically aimed at helping governments and NGOs fight the COVID-19 pandemic. We know that the funding we're providing will save lives in partnership with the efforts of each of the countries on the continent by improving public health education, protecting healthcare facilities, and increasing laboratory, disease surveillance, and rapid response capacity.
He gave the example of Nigeria, where USAID is providing almost $38 million to help Africa's most populous nation respond to COVID-19 outbreak.
One of the more interesting partnerships is a partnership with Airtel to help Nigeria reach over a million citizens a day with critical information via both voice and text messages on social distancing, safe hygiene practices, and other preventative measures. In early April, we launched a campaign to share reliable information to assist state and local governments. We've trained hundreds of volunteers to go door to door to demonstrate how to stop the spread of COVID-19.
Since Sub-Saharan Africa reported its first case of COVID-19 over 3 months ago, the World Health Organization says the region has made progress in tackling the virus. Many countries implemented lockdowns and key public health measures highly, which appear to have helped slow the spread of the disease. However, there are concerns that if the measures are relaxed too quickly, COVID-19 cases could start increasing rapidly. Staley said the assistance included providing ventilators. In May, the U.S. donated the first 50 of up to 1,000 ventilators bound for South Africa.
We have a number of countries that we're talking to across the continent about the provision of ventilators.
In Uganda, USAID has extended some $3.6 million for COVID-specific assistance, and about $1.3 million of that is related to humanitarian assistance for refugees and host communities, some of the most vulnerable communities in the pandemic. Christopher Ranyan, a senior coordinator of Africa Bureau for USAID, gave an assessment of Africa's health systems compared with other regions.
Health system capacity in Africa ranges from South Africa, currently ranked 33 out of 100 in the Global Health Security Index, which is one of the indices that we use, to Somalia, which is currently struggling.
The continent, some say, has recorded significant progress over the last 20 years. Childhood mortality has been reduced by almost 50%, and while there has been a 30% growth in population, maternal child health has improved dramatically. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Meanwhile, the UN has released $40 million from its Central Emergency Response Fund to help tackle a new outbreak of Ebola and other health and humanitarian crisis in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The reemergence of Ebola in Mbandaka in DRC's Equator province a week ago has dashed hopes of finally bringing this deadly disease to a timely end. More than 2,200 people have died since the epidemic started in eastern Ituri, north and south Kivu provinces in August 2018. Meanwhile, international support for humanitarian operations in Congo has fallen off a cliff. The UN hopes its injection of $40 million to tackle Ebola and other health and humanitarian crises in the country will kickstart a more generous response from donors. To date, the United Nations has received only 13% of this year's $2 billion appeal. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs notes the DRC is battling a dangerous mix of health and humanitarian crises, including the COVID-19 pandemic. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke acknowledges the fight against the pandemic is putting economies around the world under enormous financial strain. But he tells VOA the fight against the coronavirus cannot be won unless it is won in all countries. He adds the fight against COVID-19 must not be waged at the expense of other critical humanitarian needs.
The fight against other diseases, measles, Ebola, other issues such as hunger, child malnutrition, and so on, will continue unless we also continue to direct funding to those issues. So we are asking the donors not to make a choice either or, but to do both.
The DRC is struggling under a plethora of humanitarian needs. Besides Ebola, including the world's largest measles outbreak, as well as conflict and massive displacement in the eastern part of the country. Laerke warns failure to provide the means to tackle these problems will have widespread repercussions.
People will only survive if we fight all of this at the same time, because if we take our eyes off the ball of one disease, another one will pop up and they will die from that instead.
Money from the emergency fund will strengthen the DRC's health services for Ebola survivors and get community-based surveillance and rapid response systems running. The fund also will provide food, shelter, water and sanitation, and a myriad of other essential services, including containment measures for COVID-19. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Libyan Parliament Speaker Akila Saleh and Khalifa Haftar, whose Libyan National Army has been engaged in a lengthy siege of Tripoli, have appealed for Egypt to mediate following a series of military victories by the UN-recognized Government of National Accord. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi launched an initiative calling for a ceasefire effective today and urged the United Nations to invite Libya's rival administrations for talks. The initiative urged the withdrawal of foreign mercenaries from all Libyan territory, dismantling militias and handing over their weaponry so that Libyan National Army be able to carry out its military and security responsibilities and duties. The GNA rejected the Egyptian initiative, and its interior minister, Fatih Bash Aga, said upon retaking Sirte and the Jufra base in central Libya that GNA will be open to political talks with the East. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi spoke with Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libyan Analysis, about the timing and significance of this initiative.
So I think the key thing to note here is that the symbolic nature of both Haftar and Saleh, who is the head of the HOR, being together with Sisi was very important, because these two men in the East there have been differences between them, and Haftar has generally, until recently, rejected the idea of a political solution, and therefore the fact that they're together with Sisi in this political initiative is significant. Egypt now is only announcing a political initiative when the LNA has been completely defeated in Western Libya. They are really defending their positions now in the centre of Libya. And really what is shown in the wording of this initiative is that this is a political solution that is really designed to strengthen the position of the LNA and of the Eastern Libyan bloc in general. The fact that the terms, as you mentioned there, cite that all militias need to hand over their weapons and to the LNA, the idea that the LNA is therefore the de facto security provider for the whole country, this is a key part of what the whole conflict has been about. So really, this initiative has made Egypt and the Eastern Bloc look as if they are taking the high ground, as if they're the ones saying, okay, let's now agree a ceasefire. In reality, it's very unlikely in the immediate term that a ceasefire will come from this, because they haven't discussed it with the GNA. The GNA hasn't accepted the term, and the posturing and the stance is very much designed to strengthen the east of Libya rather than being a balanced approach that both kind of sides of the conflict could get on board with.
The GNA already rejected the Egyptian initiative, and its interior minister Fathi Bash Aga said upon retaking Sirte and Jafra base in central Libya, GNA will be open to entering political talks with the East. What is the significance of retaking the two cities, and would Russia allow that military advance after deploying its MiGs to the base as a line in the sand not to cross?
Both Sirte and Jufra are significant, and this is because they sit in the middle, the centre of Libya, and really they mark the dividing line between eastern and western Libya. The GNA controlled Sirte until January this year, so they would be very keen to retake that. That's a more recent loss for them. The LNA has controlled Jufra airbase for much longer, but it is its key airbase in central Libya. Now, for the GNA, they are concerned that if they allow the LNA to maintain their positions in Sirte and Jufra, then actually it means that they will still be able to potentially launch another assault on Tripoli, not likely in the immediate term, but say in the next few weeks or months. The additional concern for the GNA is that Russia has become embedded in both these places, both Sirte and particularly Jufra. So the GNA is concerned that if they don't push and take control of these locations, then Russia could bed in and basically secure those locations for the longer term, and therefore, you know, in effect, have a de facto partition of Libya. Now, Russia is unlikely, as you've said, it's a line in the sand for them. So they are likely to deploy some of their both foreign mercenaries as well as some of the jets and other aerial assets which they do have in the country, though haven't been using recently. Therefore, we're likely to see the conflict over Sirte and Jufra to be much more protracted and potentially much more bloody than the last few days where the GNA have pushed through very quickly. So I think this could be a new front line in the ongoing conflict rather than marking the end of the conflict, unfortunately.
So what's needed now from the US, UN and the international community to pave the way for a political solution in Libya as the two rivals came out with no final victor?
And this is a difficult question because ultimately some sort of ceasefire and political agreement is needed in order to resolve this conflict and in order to provide some semblance of normality, security, stability for Libyan citizens who are the ones who are suffering from this conflict. The problem with that is that there are so many different international foreign actors who have interest in Libya. For the most part, their interests are not really related to the well-being of the Libyan people. And this applies not just for key actors such as Russia, Turkey, the UAE, who have been actively supporting one side or the other, but also for the likes of the US. The US has been pushing on the one hand a political solution and ceasefire, but it also has a very anti-Russia stance and therefore is being very motivated in its policy in Libya by that Russian element. On the other hand, the Trump administration are more closely aligned to the politics and policies of Egypt and the UAE and have really been pushing the UAE's perspective on Libya. So it's all a really big mess at the moment and a lot of competing interests across the board. So the real challenge is going to be the UN and any other actors, how they're going to be able to create a political initiative that is fair, that all of the Libyan parties trust and that doesn't have ulterior motives. And I think that's going to be very difficult to do, unfortunately.
That was Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Tanzania's president endorsed inhaling steam to prevent coronavirus. Some have flocked to shops selling steam machines, even though health experts say there is no evidence the method has any impact on COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus. Charles Kombe reports from Dar es Salaam.
Msafiri Mjema is making good money with a steam machine that he invented. He says people are coming to buy his product ever since President John Magufuli declared that steam works against the coronavirus. He says he now makes up to $200 a day.
Zamani clinic ilikuwa inaingiza 70 laki lakini kwa sasa hivi.
Mjema says before in his clinic he was earning 70,000 to 100,000 shillings, but now he earns 500,000, and there's one day that he earned up to 1 million. He adds that is just the beginning. 2 months ago, the Tanzanian leader suggested inhaling steam could be a coronavirus treatment.
Wizara ya Afya waendelee kuifafanua ni namna gani swala la kujifukizia.
Magufuli said the Ministry of Health should continue to clarify how inhaling steam helps to contain the coronavirus. He says, adding that if those viruses are in the nose or mouth, they will melt when the temperature reaches above 100 degrees centigrade. He says that is also an important thing. Jen Makiao has put her faith in steam and comes for the treatment.
Najifukiza kwa sababu unajua kuna corona.
Jenny says she steams because she knows there's the coronavirus, adding that when you get out from the steaming booth, your body becomes more comfortable. Even President Magufuli and their ministers recommend steaming because they know its importance, she says. But health experts warn there's no evidence steam protects anyone from the coronavirus, adding that inhaling steam could even cause health problems. Dr. Sajad Fazel is a general practitioner.
Ni muhimu kuelewa kwamba hakuna sayansi yoyote itayokuwa inaleta udhibiti.
Fazel says it is better to understand that there's no scientific proof of this, adding that one can't rely on steaming as the cure for the coronavirus. He also says it is better that people understand that there are effects of inhaling steam. He also says some people may get a certain type of pneumonia that causes lungs problems, and this may increase their chance to contract the coronavirus. In the meantime, Mjema continues to make money with his service from people who believe that steam somehow will protect them from the infection. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Dar es Salaam.
The Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions is urging workers to reject salaries pegged to the weakening local currency starting this month. Rutendo Maweri reports from Harare.
ZCTU President Peter Mutasa says hyperinflation has eroded salaries, so private and public workers should insist on foreign currency salaries.
Prices of goods and services are now in US dollars, pegged in US dollars, and our salaries have remained lagging behind and in Zimbabwean dollars. So workers are now struggling. We are all thrown into abject poverty. We can't pay for rentals. We can't pay for medical care. We can't pay for school fees. We can't buy food. Workers are in a misery.
Mutasa says they also want a new inclusive economic blueprint.
Of our intention to mobilize workers and to call for collective action if the government does not immediately reform, come up with reforms, economic reforms, to ensure that we have a pro-poor and pro-worker economic development plan.
A government teacher and president of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, Obet Masaraure, concurs.
We are buying goods and we are getting services being priced in United States dollar terms or any other foreign currency. So it is very unfair for any employer to be still paying in local currency.
An economist with the Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe, Prosper Chitambara, also says the calls are justified.
Call by the ZCTU for workers' salaries to be paid in USD has been caused by the loss of value of the local currency owing to the chronic high inflation. We've also seen a gradual re-dollarization of the economy, with most service providers preferring to be paid in United States dollars. So it makes it very difficult for workers that are earning ZIM dollars to be actually able to eke out a living.
However, President of the Employers Confederation of Zimbabwe Industries, Israel Murefu, says many of its members will not be able to pay workers in foreign currency, insisting they are selling their goods in Zimbabwe dollars. Murefu says only a few companies that export, like those in the mining sector, will be able to pay foreign currency-based salaries, and that some are already doing it. Efforts to get government comment were not immediately successful. In his Workers' Day commemoration speech, President Emmerson Mnangagwa said government continues to adjust workers' earnings with a view towards a living wage, but the goal of taming inflation and the general cost of living has remained elusive. For VOA, this is Rutendo Maweri in Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Sports.
sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.